The gospel is written in the 12th chapter of Luke. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me to be a judge or arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And he told them this parable: "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be when whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God.'" Imagine your surprise to be sitting down reading the paper one morning, when on page 6 you discover your own obituary. Now, imagine further that this is not a very flattering one. The writer describes your collection of prized memorabilia as a hoard of selfish extravagance. Your life's work is derided as having been exploitation of the less fortunate. Your carefully planned savings, the result of ill-gotten gain. Your life was meaningless. We'll come back to that story later. This morning we're continuing in our series where we're looking at the parables of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. And last week we said that Luke is somewhat unique. Luke wasn't one of the people that followed Jesus around the Judean countryside. He was, in fact, a Greek doctor. And he became a Christian and set about to try to take the accounts of Jesus, the eyewitness stories of Jesus, and to put them into an orderly account. And so he's got a few things in his stories of Jesus that we don't find in the other writers. And we're specifically looking at those parables that we find only in the Gospel of Luke. And that's what our parable is this morning. We defined a parable last week as an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. So these are stories that Jesus tells to try to illustrate points about the spiritual world, the spiritual reality around us, that in one of our hymns this morning we sang, is sometimes clouded from our eyes. Now, these are difficult verses to listen to this morning, but there is a silver lining, and I hope you hear that in our sermon. So let's dive in. I'm going to be looking at our gospel kind of verse by verse this morning. And hopefully as we do that, you'll see some things that maybe you missed when we read it from beginning to end. First of all, Jesus has been preaching for months by the time we get to this parable, perhaps even as much as a year. So his message was reasonably well known in the Judean countryside. He'd been attracting huge crowds. And if you look at Luke 12 before this parable, you'll find that Jesus isn't talking at all about money. Until this guy stands up in the middle of the crowd and says, "Hey Jesus, make my brother give me my stuff." Now, I don't know if you've ever been speaking in public or perhaps teaching when someone shouts out something that's completely unrelated to what you're talking about. That's happened to me a few times as a teacher. It usually goes something like this: "Can anyone tell me what we're talking about when we're talking about the parts of an atom?" And someone raises their hand and you call on them and you're excited because they raise their hands and you think they remembered something from yesterday, and they say, "Can I go to the bathroom?" I think that's what this might have been kind of like for Jesus. Notice, though, that Jesus doesn't step into the fray. He doesn't try to engage this fellow on what the problem is. You see, there were a couple of different rules in place for inheritance. One of them went something like this: the eldest gets everything. in which case it should have been pretty clear cut. The other rule in place went that you, if there's five boys, you divide the property up into six parts, and the oldest gets two of the six parts. That's the way that the rules generally worked. So depending on which laws were in operation at the time, it should have been pretty clear cut. But I'm sure what's going on in this young man's mind is, well, my brother isn't dividing the property equally. You know, it makes sense if all of your property is in the Minnesota River Valley and it's all flat and it all grows the same amount of grain. But this guy might have gotten all the swamp land and his brother got the good land. And we just don't know what the background of the story is. But what Jesus does is he cuts to the heart of the matter. Jesus recognizes that what this guy's real issue is covetousness. He says, be on your guard against every form of greed. I'm sure this guy, he'd been listening to Jesus preach about love and preach about forgiveness, and the only thing he can think about is, but my brother's got my stuff. He's got what ought to be mine. So Jesus is warning us today about something that is in the heart of everyone. The Greek word that he uses, which is why sometimes you'll see this translated as covetousness and sometimes greed, is a word pleonexia. And pleonexia was thought of as the Greeks like a disease. It was the disease of avarice, the disease of wanting to possess more, of never quite being satisfied. Here's a picture of the Dead Sea. And the Greek philosophers compare pleonexia to this, someone who's thirsty, and then so they start drinking the seawater. And the more they drink, the thirstier they get, until eventually they drink themselves to death. That's what pleonexia is like. It's this covetousness and greed that we just can't seem to quench. The Israelites had this too. That's why we find this as two of the Ten Commandments. Not coveting our neighbor's house or wife or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And these are the Israelites who had just left Egypt with next to nothing. It's what's on their back. And they're going, that guy's donkey is nicer than my donkey. I wish I had his tent. Man, they've got an awful lot of blankets. Covetousness. Now, I think that covetousness for us displays itself in a couple of different ways. And we all struggle with this, whether we're in the top 1% or the bottom 99% in our society. The first is a desire for more and bigger stuff. Now, I had a I had a student in Macedonia who, I loved this kid. He was just a great kid. His name was Oliver, and he was a cute kid. And Oliver sometimes had a bad case of pleonexia. See, Oliver was an embassy kid, and he had the availability of Amazon, which most kids in Macedonia didn't have. And he could order stuff on Amazon and get it delivered for free. And so one week, Oliver would have a really cool scooter. And it was the coolest thing ever. And he just loved that scooter. But by the end of the week, it had gotten kind of old. And so then he'd order a whipstick, or ripstick. And the guy had one of those two-wheeled skateboards. And that was the coolest thing ever. And Oliver would ride that thing all over the parking lot, and he'd show off how cool his ripstick was. But by the end of the week, it was kind of old. And then he'd get a longboard, and the longboard would be the coolest thing. You get the picture? I think all of us feel that sometimes. And what we find is that more stuff doesn't make us happy. That's the one way that pleonexia shows up in our lives. So Jesus tells this story. And it's important at this point that Jesus isn't really criticizing the man in the story for being rich. I want you to make sure that you're clear about that. He just says there was this rich man. He doesn't criticize him for being rich. Throughout the Old Testament, riches are thought of as a blessing. Even in Ecclesiastes, the wealth that's gained by the teacher isn't thought of as necessarily a curse, it's a blessing. But Jesus and James repeatedly warn that it's difficult for the rich to enter into heaven. And this parable helps us to understand why. So we're going to start back with verse 16. Notice in verse 16 that Jesus says, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest." Now I want you to notice then, what yields the abundant harvest? It's the ground. God creates the earth. God sends the rain. What did the rich man do? He simply harvested it. Jesus gives the rich man no credit for the harvest of the crop. Now, several years ago, I read a book by a man named Jared Diamond. And the book was called Guns, Germs, and Steel. Has anyone read it? It was a really interesting book. And he was a geographer, and he was hypothesizing in his book that the wealth of nations, like the United States and nations in Europe, are really largely accidents of geography, climate, and the abundance of natural resources. Now, I didn't agree with all of Jared Diamond's assertions, but I could see some truth in what he was writing. We like to think that we're all self-made, that everything that we have is because of our work. But one example that Jared Diamond used was the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala Aquifer is here in the west central part of the U.S. It stretches from Texas in the south all the way up to, I think, South Dakota in the north. It's huge. It holds trillions of gallons of water. The thing about the Ogallala Aquifer, though, is that it's fossil water. It's all left over after the last ice age. Here's the thing about the Ogallala Aquifer. It's because of the presence of the Ogallala Aquifer right there that the United States has been able to grow this plentiful amount of grain that we've grown in the western part of the U.S., much of it through irrigation. You see the pancake fields underneath the picture up on the screen. Now, it's not that the farmers haven't worked hard. They have. But their toil has paid off because of this gift of a natural resource, the water beneath the ground. What we are entrusted to do is to be stewards of this natural resource. And with the case of the Ogallala, the water table is dropping about 5 feet per year. In some places, beginning in the 1940s, it's dropped so much that the water table is actually more than 100 feet lower than it was when farmers started irrigating in the 1940s. Now we compare this, for example, to the Sahel in Africa, which is approximately the same geographically. It's a big plain. It's got about the same climate as the southern plains in the United States. But what it doesn't have is a big aquifer underneath. See, people in the Sahel can work just as hard, but because they don't have that natural wealth of the water, their work doesn't produce as much. So, in verse 16, we see that one of the first mistakes that the rich man is going to make is he's not giving credit to whom credit is due for his wealth. Now let's look at verses 17 through 18. As we read this, it says, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain.'" Now, the thing is that by most of our standards today, this guy is a success story. This guy is saving for the future. This guy is wealthy. This guy is, and this is just a throw to yesterday where there were a couple of folks at our conference, the LCMC conference, that brought this up. This guy's like Donald Trump. But the parable doesn't really end there. We have to find out what's wrong. So I have a couple of ideas about what's wrong. One is, this guy's hoarding stuff. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the television show Hoarders. Anybody watch that? This is a compulsion for some people to hoard their things to the extent that they can't even find their way into their kitchen. I watched a few episodes of this week just to get a sense of it. And I was reminded of my Aunt Hattie. She was actually my great-great-aunt. She was my great-grandmother's sister. And she didn't marry, and she stayed at the family farm in South Dakota. And one year I remember going through, and we wanted to stop and see her. We hadn't ever visited her. And she met us at the door, and she wouldn't let us into her house because there was no place to go in her house. It was all just stuff piled up to the ceilings. She was a hoarder. The sad thing about people that hoard is that at the bottom of these piles, everything turns into rot. It's all just turning into soil. No matter what, as we store stuff, it eventually disintegrates. It loses its meaning, and we put our stuff before people. But sometimes hoarding doesn't take its form in garbage stacked in houses. Sometimes hoarding takes its form in very neat, very orderly storage sheds. I know I've got four of them. Now, only two of them really have much in them. But I still think about those storage sheds and I think, do I really need that stuff that's in those storage sheds? Because after all, most of it I packed into the storage sheds 6 years ago before we left for Korea. We haven't really looked at it much since. Here's another thought. Maybe the problem with this guy isn't hoarding. Maybe it's just saving. Now, and that's a big question for us, is when does saving become hoarding? And I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't save. You know, we know that saving for the future is absolutely necessary. In fact, you can go forward one. In fact, the U.S. has probably too low of a savings rate. But at what point does saving for the future really become about simply being scared about the future? About being fearful of the future? And you never think you have enough stored up. You never think you have enough saved because what if something happens in the future? One of the questions we have to ask ourselves with savings then is, how much is enough? And are we saving for the right reason? Because if we don't, we become like Scrooge. Remember Scrooge? His problem wasn't that he had money. His problem was the fact that he was really a hoarder, not in material things, not in stuff, but in the size of his bank account and what he did with it and didn't do with it. So, we go on to verse 19. In verse 19, and I just want you to listen on this one, okay? In verse 19, I want you to listen to the words I and my. And I want you to use your fingers, and I want you to, as you listen, count the number of times you hear these two. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. There I will store my surplus grain, and I will say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" How many times did you hear I or my? Ten. I counted nine in that. Anybody else get nine? Nine, eight, okay. Anybody else in the story? It's just the rich guy, right? You never once in the story have him say something like, "What shall I do? I will give this to my neighbors. What shall I do? I will look to see if there is someone in need in my community." The rich man never says that. It's all about him. It's all about the party that he's going to have with his money. And it doesn't even sound like anybody else is invited to the party. It's all about him. The thought of people in need never crosses his mind. But in the Old Testament, remember Abraham? He is wealthy by the standards of his age, but God says he is to be blessed to be a blessing. the idea that the rich man in our parable may have been given a great blessing so that he might bless others never crosses his mind, and therefore he's called a fool. Jesus doesn't use the word fool very often, but it's used a lot in Proverbs, and every time it is, it's denoting someone who lives their lives as if God doesn't exist. Remember last week I drew a picture of faith, and it was a circle, and the arrows for someone who's living a selfish faith, the arrows always point in to I. Now let's take a look at verse 20. And God says to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you." So here's the most important problem in our parable. He can't take any of it with him anyway. He really has a false sense of security. And this is the greatest irony of so much of modern wealth management, insurance protection, and retirement planning. We are encouraged to plan for what might happen to us in the future, but our system tends to trivialize what surely will happen to every single one of us. Every single one of us will someday have our lives demanded of us. We're all going to die. So here's verse 21. "This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." So what do we do? Well, first, Jesus says in John 6:29, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one that he has sent." So the first thing is to understand the truth of the gospel. To be rich towards God is to believe in the work of his Son. Remember, God sent his Son so that he could die for our sins on the cross. That's what the crucifixion was all about. And so that he could rise again. And by belief in that and understanding and living our lives in gratitude for that action, we're right with God. And then, in grateful love for what he has given us, not as a way to earn our way to heaven, but in grateful obedience, you love your neighbor as yourself. And you all know this. We talked about it last week, and we've talked about it a lot. But this is why it's hard for a rich man to get into heaven. Why it's harder than for a camel to get through the eye of a needle. See, it's all this stuff. It's all of this self-made man business that we pump ourselves full of. It takes our attention away from being rich towards God. And I'm saying we in this sentence because as Americans, even those of us who are in the lower middle class are among the richest people on this planet. We are living in the top 10% globally. The average global wage is about $10,000 per person per year. But more than one-third of the population lives on less than $2 per day. And that's what James is talking about in our epistle today. So, on a practical level, what do we do with this? What can we take home with us from this today? How can we guard against the fate of the rich man? Well, I'm going to suggest three gauges that we can use. First, we should have an attitude of stewardship. You should ask yourselves the question, what are you giving for God's kingdom? And you can break this down into a couple of different questions. The first is, who do you give it to? Now, I'm not preaching the sermon this morning to try to convince you to give more money to Zohar Church. I'm preaching this morning because you should, in your lives, be thinking, how can I further the kingdom of God here on earth? What are those missions, ministries, places where I see the need for what I have to be shared? The Bible suggests a tithe of 10%, but see, that's hard too, because what is it a 10% of? Is it 10% of gross annual income, of adjusted annual income? Is it a minimum amount? Is it a maximum amount? Who do you give it to? When do you give it to? And see, this is what the Pharisees were all about. In Matthew 23:23, Jesus criticizes them because what the Pharisees are doing is they're taking their little spice gardens, you know, and they're taking their spices and they're drying and then they're chopping them up and then they're weighing them out to make sure that they're giving exactly 10% of their spices to the temple. It's not about that. It's about looking around and seeing how you can benefit the community around you. And I'm not judging you. No human being can do that. You're the one who judges yourselves in this. Because sacrificial giving is simply a measure of how much we're prepared to trust God rather than ourselves. And that's gauge number one. So here's gauge number two. It's an attitude of generosity. And this is the question. How are you using what you already have? Are you using it selfishly? Or are you building relationships? Is the back of your pickup truck so pristinely clean and nothing ever touches it because it's your truck that you're not willing to haul somebody else's dogs around? Are your power tools so precious that nobody else is allowed to touch them? Or you're not even willing to use them for somebody else's project. See, that's what the attitude of generosity is all about. And I think that this is what Jesus means in Luke 16:9 when he says, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. What I think he means by that is the use of your worldly wealth is all for relationships. It's for the people around you. It's to enjoy the relationships with your neighbors and your family and your friends. It's not to hoard it, to stash it away for a day that may never come. It's not to keep it in big piles because it's just going to rot anyway. So, the third one is an attitude of carefree simplicity. And I'll think about that in a couple of ways. First, when something happens to your stuff, how do you react? So let's say you've got something invested in an investment account, and you think it's a pretty safe, secure account, and all of a sudden it loses 30% of its value. How do you react? Do you jump up and down and scream? Do you call in and threaten your investor? Do you... In the case of some people who lost more than that amount in 2008, you jump out of a window. Because you know what? It's just stuff. Those are just blips on a screen. That's really what they are. Or when you come out of the Shopko in Two Harbors and you've been shopping and you come out to the parking lot and there is a big dent in the side of your car. Do you call the police? Do you yell and scream? Do you accuse the person who might have just pulled into the stall next to you but had nothing to do with the dent of denting your car? How do you react to that? Because after all, yeah, it's annoying, but it's just stuff. Or what about when someone breaks your favorite dish or your vase or an heirloom? Or in my case, We went to China and we went to this place where they carved jade balls, where there's like three or four balls each inside of another. Have you seen those? They're kind of cool. We sat and we watched them carve a ball, and then we could buy some that were actually carved by the apprentices, not the masters. And we got one, and we transported it to Macedonia, and it was sitting on a shelf in Macedonia, and I bumped the shelf, and I watched it roll across the shelf, and I was running to try to grab it, and it smashed on the floor. What do you do in that situation? What's your attitude towards your stuff? That one was hard for me. It took Michelle to say, it's okay. The next part of this, though, is the freedom of just getting rid of some of your stuff. That's part of gauge number three also. That's part of that carefree attitude. My mom and dad go to a church that has two annual rummage sales, one in the spring and one in the fall. And their church gets rid of lots of stuff. It's actually become the whole community that does this. And here's the amazing thing. Last year, they raised $40,000 at rummage sales, getting rid of stuff. And then they take that $40,000, and they've got a formula that they use ahead of time, and they take about a fourth of it, and a fourth of it stays in the congregation for things that the congregation needs. A fourth of it they use in the local community for various projects, missions, ministries in the local community. Another fourth of it they use kind of on a national scale. It's going to stay in the United States, but it's on a national scale. And then another fourth they send to some overseas project. So what people do by getting rid of their stuff is they convert it into mission. They're able to use it for something greater. Now, we don't necessarily have a rummage sale here at Zohr, but Odds and Ends is just up the road. And Odds and Ends gives all of their proceeds to ministries and missions. So think about that. Maybe you're like me, and you've got at least one storage shed full of stuff that you haven't looked at for 6 years. And maybe some of it could be converted into missions. Okay. So now maybe we have a better idea of what Jesus is calling us to be when it comes to our relationship with stuff. Remember the story I told you at the beginning of the sermon? It was actually true. That's actually the experience of this man, Alfred Nobel. See, Alfred Nobel was born in 1833 in Stockholm, Sweden. And as a young man, he worked at his father's arms factory. In 1864, a deadly explosion killed his younger brother, and so Alfred decided that he was going to spend his life coming up with a safer alternative to the liquid explosives and the powdered explosives that were being used at the time. And so he invented dynamite, which you could transport safely. It would only go off when you lit the fuse. Dynamite established Nobel's fame, and it was soon being used to blast tunnels, to cut canals, to build railroads, and to build roads all over the world. But it was also the basis for modern weaponry. And with these modern explosives, mankind could kill with ruthless efficiency, as happened during some of the European wars at the end of the 19th century. It was also pointed out that oftentimes the safety of the workers who built the canals and the tunnels and the railways was not paid very close attention to, and that many people had died in the blasts to build these modern structures. And so in 1888, Alfred was living in Paris when his brother Ludwig died. A French newspaper got who had died wrong. They erroneously believed that it was Alfred who had died, and so they published an obituary in the local newspaper about Alfred Nobel's life. And Alfred read how horrible of a person he was, how his life's work was all gained through the selling of death. And he decided that he needed to change. You know, we serve a God who's a God of the second chance. And so Alfred Nobel decided that for the rest of his life, he was going to work to establish funds that would recognize people who had worked to achieve great achievements in physics and chemistry, medicine and literature, and especially in peace. And that's why today we have the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, we can't all be Alfred Nobel. And I'm not even intending to characterize what his faith might have been. But we can keep our attention on what, and more importantly, on who is truly important. And then, in grateful response, live accordingly. So that when our soul is required of us, we are welcome not with fool, but with well done, good and faithful servant. Amen.